they called him the ghost pilot. Not because he was dead, because nobody could figure out how he was still alive. In the 1930s and early 40s, Harold Gillam flew the Alaska bush routes in weather that made other pilots look out the window, shake their heads, and go back inside for another cup of coffee. Soup. Zero ceiling. Mountain passes filling in with clouds so thick you couldn't see your own wingtips. Gillam flew anyway. He flew when the forecasters said don't. He flew when the other pilots said you're out of your mind. He flew when the smart money said the weather would kill you before noon. And somehow the weather never did, until January of 1943. When the mountains above southeastern Alaska finally caught up with him, and what happened to the five people on that airplane is one of the most extraordinary survival stories the bush flying world has ever produced. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair. This one's gonna take a while. Before we get into the crash, you have to understand who Harold Gillam was. And to understand that, you have to understand what bush flying in Alaska in the 1930s actually meant. There were no VOR stations, no instrument landing system, no radar coverage, no satellite weather imagery. You got a weather report if you were lucky, and that report usually came from someone at the far end of a telegraph line who looked out his window and described what he saw. Pilots navigated by rivers they had memorized, by mountain passes they had memorized, by the color of the sky at 4 in the afternoon, by the feel of the air under the wings. And when the weather closed in, which in Alaska it did with terrifying regularity, you either turned around or you made a decision that could be your last. Most pilots turned around. Gillam didn't. He came to Alaska around 1930 and started building routes out of Fairbanks, Anchorage, Cordova, Valdez. He was carrying mail, freight, the occasional passenger, connecting communities that had no roads, no railroads, nothing between them and the outside world but whatever an airplane could deliver. The whole enterprise was operating at the edge. The aircraft of that era, open cockpits transitioning to enclosed cabins, instruments that told you some things but not all things, radio that worked when it worked, and the Alaska weather sitting above all of it like a permanent adversary. Gillam built a reputation. A specific, unusual reputation. Not just that he was good, but that he flew in conditions that grounded everyone else. If the ceiling was on the deck and the other pilots were sitting on their hands, somebody would say, well, call Gillam. And Gillam would come. And Gillam would go. The nickname some people used wasn't flattering. Thrill'em, spill'em, kill'em Gillam. That came from the crashes he'd survived over the years. He'd walked away from situations that should have been fatal. A forced landing here, an incident there, and each time he walked away, the legend grew a little bigger, and the mythology thickened around him. The ghost pilot. The man the weather couldn't touch. What Gillam actually was, and this is important, was a pilot of exceptional skill with a particular relationship to risk. He had accumulated thousands of hours in some of the most demanding flight environment on Earth. He understood Alaska weather in a way that went beyond what you could learn in a classroom. He read ice fog and mountain wave, and the way clouds moved through a pass like some people read a book. And he trusted himself, possibly more than he should have, in conditions that demanded a great deal of humility from anyone. Now here's something the mythology tends to gloss over. The pilots who built those Alaska routes, who flew those mail contracts through the 1930s, they weren't reckless for the sake of recklessness. They were doing necessary work. People in the villages along those routes depended on what those airplanes brought, medicine mail, the materials to survive a winter. When you understand that, you understand why Gillam flew in the weather he flew in. The weather was always bad. If you only flew when conditions were good, you didn't fly. And if you didn't fly, people did without. The calculation was real, the stakes were real. But there's a point where skill and experience can start to feel like a guarantee. And a guarantee is something the Alaska backcountry has never offered anyone. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. On January 5, 1943, Harold Gillam departed the Seattle area in a Lockheed Electra 10A, a twin-engine aircraft, clean and capable by the standards of the day. Real altitude, real speed, enclosed cockpit with instruments. For Alaska bush flying in the early 40s, it was modern equipment. He was carrying mail, supplies, and 5 passengers. 5 people who needed to get north, who had trusted their lives to the ghost pilot because in wartime 1943, Harold Gillam was one of the few ways to get where you needed to go. Those 5 passengers were Percy Cutting, a civilian contractor working on military installations, Susan Batzer, a young woman working for the Army, Bob Gibo, Joseph Tippetts, and Dewey Metzdorf. The route north from Seattle in January is not a casual flight under any circumstances. You are threading through mountain ranges, crossing open water, dealing with weather systems that develop fast and move faster. Southeastern Alaska in winter is a particular kind of hostile. The mountains there come up steep and hard out of the sea. The clouds sit down on the treetops, and the passes fill in without warning. The terrain doesn't give you second chances. You make the wrong turn in a mountain pass in that country, and there's no going around. There's only through or not at all. Gillum encountered weather over southeastern Alaska. How bad it was when he first found it, how quickly it deteriorated, whether he made a deliberate call or got surprised by something that moved faster than it should have, we will never know. The airplane's last moments aren't on any recording. What we know is that somewhere in the mountains, roughly 70 miles east of Ketchikan, the Lockheed stopped flying and the mountains claimed it. The trees in that country are old growth, Sitka spruce. They run 200 feet tall in places. When an airplane goes down in terrain like that, the forest closes over it the way water closes over a stone. From above, from any search aircraft trying to locate a wreck, there is nothing. Just the canopy and the silence and the snow. Dewey Metzdorf did not survive the crash. He died at the wreck, and there was nothing the others could do. But four people were still alive: Percy Cutting, Susan Batzer, Bob Gibo, Joseph Tippetts, and Harold Gillum, battered and injured, but breathing. And here's where the story takes its hardest turn. Harold Gillum, the ghost pilot, the man who had cheated death more times than anyone could count, made a decision at the crash site. He was going for help. He was injured. This much is documented. He was in deep snow and heavy terrain at altitude in January in southeastern Alaska, and he was injured, and he left the wreck on foot because he believed that if anyone was going to bring rescue to those people, he had to be the one to do it. He knew the terrain better than his passengers did. He was the pilot, whatever the reasoning was. Gillum walked away from the wreck and into the mountains. He got about 6 miles. They found Harold Gillum's body weeks later. He had covered remarkable ground given his injuries. He died in the attempt. In his last hours, the ghost pilot, the man who had flown through conditions that should have killed him a dozen times, spent what remained of his strength trying to reach help for the people he had been carrying. Whatever else you want to say about the career, about the risks he accepted, and the philosophy behind them, the last calculation Harold Gillum ever made was to trade his own life for a chance at theirs. The four survivors, meanwhile, were doing something that deserves to be remembered every time someone talks about survival in the Alaska backcountry. Think about what they had. A wrecked aircraft. January temperatures in the southeastern Alaska mountains, which can drive down well below zero with wind that finds every gap in any shelter you build, limited supplies, injuries among them, and no way to know whether anyone knew they were missing, whether anyone was searching, whether rescue was a day away or a month away or not coming at all. Susan Batzer became the center of gravity in that wreck. She was not a pilot. She was not a wilderness survival expert. She was a civilian government employee in her 20s, and by the accounts that came out after the rescue, she was the one who kept people organized, kept spirits from collapsing entirely, made the hard decisions about rationing what little food they had. She was the one who kept the group focused on doing the things that would keep them alive the next day, and then the next day after that, and then the day after that. They stayed with the airplane. In the Alaska bush, in winter, in difficult terrain, this is the right call. A wrecked airplane is shelter. It's visible from the air. Bright metal against snow and dark trees. If you leave it and start walking, you're likely trading a known problem for an unknown one, and in that country, the unknown problems tend to be fatal. They made shelter in the wreck as best they could. They stayed put. They endured. The search for Gillum's aircraft was one of the significant military search operations of the time. The Army, the Navy, the Coast Guard all put assets into the hunt. But southeastern Alaska is not a small piece of geography. The mountains east of Ketchikan are dense and steep, and the weather that contributed to the crash didn't cooperate with the searchers either. Day after day of looking, and nothing. 31 days, 31 days in January and February in the southeastern Alaska mountains. Not a week, not 10 days, a month, roughly speaking. A month of cold and hunger and the slow burn of uncertainty that is maybe the hardest part of any survival situation. You can manage cold if you have to. You can manage hunger to a point. But uncertainty, not knowing if the sound overhead is a search plane or just wind, not knowing if you're being looked for or already written off, that is a specific kind of suffering. They were found on February 5, 1943. All four alive, frostbitten, weakened, some injuries sustained that would take time to heal, but alive, all four of them. The rescue operation to extract them from that terrain was its own considerable undertaking. Susan Batzer was later recognized for her role in keeping those survivors alive, and she deserved every bit of it, In the history of Alaska Bush Aviation, which is full of stories about pilots, we don't always stop long enough to talk about the passengers, about the people who climbed into those small airplanes with their faith, placed entirely in the person at the controls, and who sometimes found themselves tested by exactly the kind of situation they were trusting the pilot to avoid. Susan Batzer passed that test for 31 days in the January mountains, and she brought three other people through with her. Harold Gillam was 41 years old when he died. He had been flying Alaska for more than a decade when the Lockheed went down east of Ketchikan. He had flown routes that didn't exist before he flew them. He had carried mail and medicine and people to places that had no other connection to the world. He had logged thousands of hours in the most demanding flight environment most of us will never see. And in the end, what the mountains gave him was an exit that matched the life. Not a quiet retirement, not a medical certificate that expired. He died in the mountains of Alaska trying to save the people he had been responsible for. I want to be careful here because I think Gillam deserves the honest version, not just the legend. He took risks. The risk tolerance that made him the ghost pilot, the guy you called when nobody else would fly, that same quality contributed to the situation that put five people in the trees east of Ketchikan on a January night. The best pilots I have known have always understood that the mountains don't care about your reputation. The weather doesn't care how many hours you have. The margin in the backcountry is thin, and it is thin every time, and it does not widen because you have survived before. The bush flying community in Alaska knows this. They have always known it. They keep the names. They remember who was lost and where. That culture of memory is not morbid, it is honest. It is the community's acknowledgement that the work involves a cost and that the cost is real and has names attached to it, and that you honor those names by understanding what happened and flying accordingly. Harold Gillam's name is on that list, and Susan Batzer's name, and Percy Cutting's name, and Bob Gibo's name, and Joseph Tippett's name are on a different kind of list. The list of people who found out exactly what they were made of in the worst possible situation and came back to talk about it. The next time I'm sitting on the ramp getting impatient with a weather delay, I'm going to think about 31 days in a wrecked Electra in the January mountains above Ketchikan, and I'm going to wait as long as I need to wait. That story comes from the historical archives of the Alaska Aviation Museum in Anchorage, and from the work of aviation historians who have documented this period of Alaska flying in detail. If you want to dig deeper into this era, the Alaska aviation history community has done remarkable work keeping these stories alive. Find a link at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. That's all for the Hangar today.